Good evening, and welcome to the Cycles of Change radio program here on May 16th, 2013. I'm your host, David Katzmeyer, coming to you as I do every Thursday night at 8 p.m. New York time and 5 p.m. Pacific. Tonight's special guest is Chris Largent, taught university-level philosophy and comparative religion for more than 30 years. And he has lectured internationally, including talks given for the New York Open Center, New York School for Practical Philosophy, Chicago's Crossroads Center, the World Business Academy, the Global Structures Convocation in Washington, D.C., the Young Institute, and the Omega Institute. He has also been a bank manager, a book editor, a publisher, a marketing manager, hypnotherapist, an advisor to graduate programs on mysticism, a transformative astrological counselor, and an advisor to businesses and government on communication, conflict resolution, time management, and team building. Chris is co-author of The Soul of Economies, Spiritual Evolution Goes to the Marketplace, The Paradigm Conspiracy, Why Our Social Systems Violate Our Human Potential and How We Can Change Them, Love, Soul, and Freedom, Dancing with Rumi on the Mystic Path. These books have been praised by many thinkers, including the Dalai Lama, Stephen Covey, Willis Harmon, Houston Smith, Ravi Batra, Charles Tart, Marianne Williamson, and famed Russian poet Yevgeny Yevtushenko. He was also a contributor to the 9/11 book, From the Ashes, A Spiritual Response to the Attack on America, Experience, Strength, and Hope from Spiritual Leaders and Extraordinary Citizens. You can find out more about Chris by visiting his site for the school that he has set up in Wilmington, Delaware, which you can find at theseventhacademy.com. We're going to talk a little bit tonight about the concept of cycles throughout the ages, how the thought of cycles has been perceived in different regions, cultures, and time, with anchoring some comparisons to how we are viewing these things now, hopefully, in the comparisons, the congruencies or juxtapositions of these concepts from different times and places versus now. It'll help us place how we see things and be more engaged with our own concepts of ourselves. So welcoming Chris Largent to our show tonight. Chris, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you very much, David.
Well, I am sure glad to have you on here tonight. Had a couple of interesting discussions with you before the show, and it was really quite intriguing. The concept of cycles, well, that's something I got into with my own work, looking at the cycles of time, the cycles of history, which repeats itself. We're all living in fractal societies. Chris, basically, you have taught so much in terms of mysticism and in philosophy, crossing over into astrology, psychology, just about all of these major schools are inextricably linked with some interest in cycles. Is there what are the concepts that many of us have today in 2013 living here in America? What is our concept of ourselves and the world around us?
I think that's a good question, because usually if we look at why the heck anybody wants to study cycles in the first place, we notice just high levels of stress. I happen to teach nursing ethics at Widener, and one of the first things that the students have to learn about is how stress is a major tax on mental, emotional, and physical health. Everybody knows that. But what we don't seem to focus on too often is that most of the time, the stresses come from too much of something. They come from overwhelm, too many demands, too much information to process on the news, especially if it's negative, too many jobs to do, too many responsibilities, too many problems to solve, too many troubles. And it's that kind of overwhelm and overload that creates this mental anxiety, the emotional stress, the physical disease, and so on. And historically, when people have responded to overwhelm and stress and anxiety and so on, they needed something to organize, arrange, strategize, prioritize their lives, and they usually only use one of two tools. That is, they either tell stories or they come up with cycles, patterns, orders, something. And those become the tools for healthy living for people. And that's why they get interested in it. So if we think of an ancient example, the seasons would be a perfectly straightforward one, because we know that ancient peoples were really interested in studying the sky and understanding in seasons what was going to happen when, the basic seasons themselves, how they changed depending on where you were on the planet, and so on. That helped them organize their lives and not get overwhelmed by all the things going on. A modern version of it might be the personality typing that came from the mother-daughter team of Myers-Briggs. And we started thinking, well, how do we figure out who's working next to us? How do we work effectively on a team? How do we get this job done? And personality typing gave us categories, which are essentially another way of talking about patterns and so on. And then in the 20th century, especially the second half of the 20th century, I must have read, I suppose, a dozen articles from experts from architecture to business. Stephen Covey is an example. You mentioned him. To people trying to write articles, start businesses, and they would give you the cycle. Here's the first, here's the second, here's the third, here's the fourth. And they almost always fell into sevens because creative orders tend to be historically from the ancient world. Mm. They turn up in sevens, right? In fact, there's a fun example for this. When people fall in love, they fall in love in seven stages. And in the ancient world, native peoples, for instance, knew this, and nobody's bothered to tell modern romantics this. So the first stage, of course, is what everybody knows. Everybody gets very excited and enthusiastic, and I'm in love with the other person, and it's wonderful, and we both like the same thing. He and she like raspberries and Brad Pitt and going out on Friday night. The second stage is where these two people have to step back, and the second stage of creativity is, I have to step back and analyze this thing a little more carefully and say, who is this person that I'm in love with? And in the second stage, and then redefining the relationship in the third, lots of times we find out, well, he actually doesn't like raspberries or Brad Pitt or going out on Thursday nights, and the two separate individuals who would then come together in the third stage in this higher definition feel as if they're falling apart in the second stage and not getting along. And so you get lots of people who, after being madly in love in the first stage, which usually lasts 6 months to a year, in the second year and sometimes the third year, they end up breaking up. And you get lots of this cycling, the joke in Four Weddings and a Funeral, this serial monogamy, because people don't realize the first stage, though it's wonderful, has to give way to this examination stage of the two separate individuals in the second stage, having them come back together in the third, so you can have a fourth stage that says, how does this thing actually work? What are its dynamics? And from there, the next three stages are expansive. And those kinds of cycles, ancient peoples, classical peoples, native peoples, just assumed those. So their approach to even something as simple as romance was a lot more sophisticated than ours, and a lot easier. It's a lot easier to think in the second stage that it's not that this person suddenly turned into someone I'm not in love with. It just turned into someone who's a someone, and I have to figure out what that someone is, and the kind of starry-eyed first stage has given way to something quite different.
Well, I could imagine that it would make it a lot easier to go through whatever stages you're in and whatever system or relationship you're in if you understand the patterns and the phases that are typical, common to us all. Why am I feeling this way? What does it mean? These are often the questions that lead to neurosis, because there's a void where there would be answers. There's no support for that because we are living in a society that doesn't understand things as well as it does understand things mechanically. I mean, the first four stages you talked about here and the seven stages of relationships, so commonly known to the emotionally aware group of Native Americans, if I may be general, is reminiscent of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. Stage one, stage two, stage three, and then once you get from there, you can go on and start going on. We see this played out in many social systems and a progress of society over time when we look at a culture. And so what we see on the individual level and on the interpersonal level, we see get played out in our civilizations, because evidently there appears to be a fractal relationship. Lo and behold, there may be a super string of social theory that shows that all of these things have common patterns that just manifest in changed form, may I say isomorphic forms, yet they all come from the same root of codes that are born into us and built into our social systems. anyway, that's a thing that I kind of reach for because I see evidence all over, Chris.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting you should use thesis, antithesis, synthesis because...
Little Hegel, yeah.
Yeah, well, the thing is, Hegel, who is a very good friend of Fichte and Schelling in Germany, the reason that's relevant is Fichte and Schelling were both really interested in freedom. And Schelling especially wrote all, his first big book was on that. And their idea was, if you understand the cycles of things, if you understand the dynamics, if you understand the patterns, that's real freedom. Freedom doesn't come from being able to choose this kind of soap in a store or that kind of soap or something where I have these little piecemeal choices. Rather, it comes from understanding big patterns, and therefore you can move freely in those. That's why there was so much of an emphasis on patterns and cycles and how, for instance, they would translate into disciplines. And there's another good example in education. Lots of what we call, if we look back at it, what we call education in native societies or in classical societies, even in classical education until progressive education took over, was education in disciplines. You master a discipline. And in those disciplines, you have things like the notes in music, the basic moves in a sport that you're learning, and so on. And having mastered those, you get freer and freer to move in them. So it's not only overcoming stress, which is a negative, but it is a positive. I feel freer as a human being and freer to express who I am.
Free your mind and your feet will follow. And absolutely. Right. Absolutely. And I perhaps that would alleviate some of the stress because, you know, neurosis is basically a deeply ingrained feeling, regardless of the impact of your daily life, that there's something wrong with you. And, you know, people feel that way when they're thinking, well, I have this sports car, I have the big house, and I've got this great job. Why don't I feel complete? And it's because it may not be emotionally fulfilling, or why are they going through a crisis? You know, if you say to an 18-year-old, I remember my teenage years, and I was starting to figure some of this stuff out, and I had a friend, a male friend, eventually went into the Marines, and he was break at age 18. We were both 18. He says, "I don't know what I'm going through," and he broke down in tears. Broke down in tears, and I said, "Well, family, anything here?" No, nothing was happening in his life. I came back to him. I said, "You know what? I think we're just programmed to feel like this when we're 18." You know what? He felt better.
Yeah. Any kind of, it's interesting, and that's the thing with either cycles or stories. When people have something that can give them some sense of meaning about what they're going through, you can take people who are terribly nihilistic and say, "I don't think there's any meaning out there," and fine, until they're in a crisis, and then there's the kind of common version of the old military line, "There are no atheists in foxholes," because, you know, people are in war, they're thinking, just in case there's a God out there, I'd like some help right now. It's the same thing with patterns, you know, around meaning. People are going through things in their lives, and they think, "I'd like to know what's happening here." And we can do, sometimes I have this thought experiment of doing a radical version of not actually knowing who you are, where in history you are, because lots of times that sounds a bit conceptual and abstract. Academic scholars love this, but lots of times people think, "Well, I don't have to know this." But if you think for a moment, imagine that one thought experiment, imagine I woke up tomorrow, and tomorrow morning I didn't understand diurnal rhythms. You said this when we were having lunch the one day. You said, "What if we didn't know that the sun is supposed to come up and then go down again? It, coming up, we might even be perfectly happy. And, wow, this is nice. Look at this thing happening." And then when it started to go down, you, "Hey, well, hold it. Where's that going?" If I didn't understand diurnal rhythms, or if I didn't know about weekly movements or months, or even how to tell time, hours be someplace, or what the seasons were about, or traffic patterns, there were lots of things. If I didn't have those cycles and patterns and orders in my life, I wouldn't know where I was. And in a relatively short period of time, I would not only lack a sense of meaning, I'd probably be panicked about the fact that all this stuff is going on here and I don't know why it's happening. And I would get overwhelmed and hugely stressed.
Absolutely. And yet there are times in our societies when we're due for a crisis, things will rise, other things will fall. These things can happen at the same time. Just as there's times in our life that we're going to go through changes, or as Gail Sheehy says, passages, or you're going to go through different kinds of adolescence at various stages of your life. Some of them have names like midlife crises and so forth. But they're coded in us, and it's a way of nature's way of shifting gears. When the stress of the equilibrium is neither high nor low, you're sort of like for a brief time, you have to be in flux in order to change what is going to be the pattern of the next quarter of development or what have you. But we would truly feel better if we understood that time does not necessarily move in just a linear sequence of events with cause and effect only. That does exist, of course. However, underlying that, too, is whether we're on waves of rising or falling tides, what season it is, where are we in the solar system. And really, things make more sense when you know what time it is. And knowing what time it is more than a 12-hour watch. Folks, if you'd like to call in, we're going to take calls at the bottom of the hour, at the half hour. And you could call in with a question for Chris or a comment, if you will, at area code 347-884-9593. That's 347-884-9593. Well, Chris, your main work is teaching philosophy, is it not?
Yes, I teach technically history of philosophy, history of religion, and the philosophy of just about anything. The beauty of being a philosopher is there's a philosophy of medicine, politics, philosophy of law. In other words, philosophers can stick their noses in practically anywhere. And so it's fun when you get to teach practically anything. So yes, technically it's philosophy in the old sense.
Absolutely. And, you know, we could use a little bit of philosophy now. It reminds me of something President John F. Kennedy said. If, you know, more poets were interested in politics and more politicians knew poetry, it would be a better world. And it pays to blend things together a little bit. And we're certainly going through a shifting time now. You wrote a book, you co-authored a book on 9/11, which is one of the quintessential events of crises that are reflecting a changing world right now, isn't it, Chris?
Mm-hmm. Well, the book on 9/11, actually it was one of those nightmare things for writers when you're working on a bunch of projects, some great big thing happens, in this case 9/11, and a publisher calls you and says, well, we're going to do this book on what just happened. And we're going to have a lot of people in the book. We're going to try to get as many people from around the world as we can. We have Bishop Tutu and the Dalai Lama, and they start going down the list. And we'd like you to write an article on the problem of evil. And I said, excuse me, what? And he said, you do have a week to do it. I said, oh, thank you, a week to solve the problem of evil. It's great. The nice thing about the book, though, was the reason I was more than happy to contribute was that the point of it was to try to give just what we're talking about, give some meaning to something that seemed to be emotionally overwhelming. How would this happen? And not only that, people just had this huge need to try to connect with each other and find meaning more as human beings. I was struck by that because I was planning to do what's now the Seventh Academy. In those days, there was an earlier incarnation of the Seventh Academy, and its first meeting was Tuesday, September 11th, 2001.
Oh, my.
You're talking about bad timing. Because, of course, we were going to get classes, and people started calling us and saying, we need to talk to process this. Can you hold that class tonight so we can process this? And I thought it was very interesting, because here's where people were looking for some way to find some meaning. And, I mean, ultimately, that wasn't going to happen. We weren't going to sit down and figure out the meaning of this thing, but we needed to come together to do that. And so there was that kind of support. But then the other thing was that because that the Seventh Academy deals only with tools for understanding and so on. One of the tools that people knew that I was working with, there are a couple, but one was these seven stages. And so, for example, in the United States, if you have nations, instead of 1 year, if you're falling in love, if you have nations, often we would talk about 100-year phases, and the United States in its first 100 years had this huge expansion that was this excitement about being a republic. And people all over Europe were excited about republics, which is why so many people came here. Mm. In the second 1,000 years, similar to the couple that starts stepping back and staring at each other in the second stage, we start having this divisive thing go on. It began with the Civil War and carried through Vietnam. And then the third stage is, okay, how do we define this? And one of the interesting things about the third stage, it tends to be one of the most dangerous, especially for nations, because it says your original vision is this old republic. Then here's the divisive movement that happens. So in the third stage, and you and I talked about this briefly, what do you want to be? Do you want to be a republic? Do you want to be the old one or a revised one? Do you want to be a democracy? You're talking about that. Or do you want to be an empire and tell everybody else what to do, which the U.S. has gotten pretty good at since World War II. And so when that happens, you get a lot of tension around the different forms that people consciously or unconsciously will attach to. And so, for instance, sometimes I do political consulting, and you notice that in Washington, that there are people in Washington who are dying to turn the U.S. into the old republic again. There are people who want the U.S. to be a democracy where everybody's involved, and then there are people who are just dying to have it be an empire that they are running. And in those moments, when those three come together dramatically, you know that you're going to have all kinds of things happening, that many of which could be dangerous, especially if you're an international. I mean, if we had been a smaller country, people might not have bothered to blow up any buildings. But in a larger country, yeah, this one gets and can have international implications. So that was part of the conversation that night, along with things that were deeper and more personal. People wanted to have a sense of, am I in some place in history where the world is just blowing up? Or is this some kind of pattern that I can at least a little bit start to get my mind around?
Yes.
So, helpful for people that night. And you know, it was a tool that otherwise would have felt very abstract, but when you're sitting in the middle of a crisis and trying to say, why is this happening? Practically anything will do.
Well, you know, just hearing you say the things that you're saying about 9/11 and looking back on American history, it's actually giving some comfort to me. That was a brilliant way of connecting that which we see on the individual level and applying it to the history of our own country. Because, and you mentioned philosophy can get into anything. Well, you look at philosophers like Oswald Spengler. He made a comparison between what you find in a person you can find in the civilization. In fact, he said that civilizations go through all the stages of life, from birth, childhood, adolescence, adulthood, senescence, and eventually death. And so here is making a direct correlation that it's the same patterns, both large and small. But on a civilization, the patterns take much greater periods of time because larger institutions are slower to change. And then there was philosopher Giovanni Battista, who also said there's such a thing as a character of a people, you were mentioning archetypes, and that a country develops a personality as does a person. So support for the concept of looking at the fractal relationship between an individual and a nation are replete and reinforced throughout time in different places, and there's many more examples that we could give. So really, if we understand some things, you know, if you wanted to understand how the solar system works, well, what did they do when we were in school? They give us a little model, and there would be the sun with all the planets going around it, and look at that, and that's what's happening up in the sky. It's only really big. And then we get it. Well, duh. A roadmap. You look at a roadmap in the United States, and you understand, okay, I got it. If you didn't have that map, it wouldn't work too well in your mind. Well, we are the maps of the civilizations we create. So if we just understand how the patterns repeat on many different layers, then it isn't an overwhelming cacophony of information overload. But fortunately, we have scholars like you who help put these pieces together, or to Campbell it, as it were. Let's make Campbell a verb here to show the commonalities in all of them. Chris, is there any references from different times of how people saw the world around them, or at least what's left in any records that we have, in comparison to where we are right now? If we look back at some of the Native American nations, back at the ancient city of Sumer, or, you know, Babylon, Rome, Greeks, any comparison, do our times remind you of any other?
Yes, actually, strikingly so, because one of the things, in addition to the seven stages for romance we were talking about, or the 100-year periods of nations, lots of historians, and even down through time, have looked at 1,000-year periods. It's a very common thing in Western thought, which led, if you may remember, Bishop James Usher, an eccentrically brilliant Scottish parson, to sit down and add up the numbers of things that happened in the Bible so he could figure out which 1,000-year period everything happened in. By the way, you'll be happy to know that he discovered that creation happened in about 4004 B.C., probably because he was in the British Isles around tea time. So you can, and he was very impressed by that. He said, oh, yeah, those are four, and then we have this big three coming and so on. Right. Okay, yeah. One of the big One of the big things is, the interesting thing about the 4,000 is that we have it at Penn, we have the whole Sumerian library. The Sumerians turned up in the, in Mesopotamia, the land in the middle between the Tigris and Euphrates, around the places where we now have Afghanistan and Iraq and Iran, and those places, the cradle of civilization, as it's often called. And the Sumerians, because we have their library, we know a great deal about what they did. In fact, in relatively fabulous detail, even what they had for dinner and that sort of thing. But one of the first things that happened, this is the beginning of a 7,000-year period that lots of people watch. That is, there's certain Western scholars that do, Native scholars that do, and so on. And one of the things they would say is that the Sumerians represented a different kind of civilization, borrowing from the famous anthropologist Rian Eisler, two different types of civilization. One is very, very, very controlling, wants empires, dictatorships, and thinks that's how you unify things. And the other is more partnership societies, and they think in terms of egalitarian interaction, that's how they organize things and unify things.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can think how that works even in our everyday life. If I go to school as a student, that's a fairly controlling atmosphere. I've been an educator for 40 years. It's a fairly controlling society. But when the kids aren't in classrooms and they're interacting with each other, or the faculty are interacting with each other, there's a little partnership societies. Well, 6,000 years ago, the Sumerians turned up with the sort of classic control model. They institutionalized everything, and as Samuel Noah Kramer, the main scholar of the Sumerians at Penn, says, they gave us the first kingship and organized government, institutionalized government, the first warriors and institutionalized warfare, the first priesthood and institutionalized religion, the first institutionalized education, the first punishment for making a mistake in a classroom. You had the master of the whip who would hit you if you made a mistake. Before that, mistakes were not demonized. First institutionalized healing, and so on. So here's a model 7,000 years ago, roughly 6,000, give or take, that set up all kinds of controlling institutions, which, if you walk down the road to the 20th century, were replicated in many societies. Not all of them were happy about it. Lots of times the controlling societies were clomping all over the partnership societies and conquering them, invading them. And we always joke about that in classes here and in my university classes. They always justified it somehow. The Sumerians turned up and said, "Hi, we're God." They literally said, "We're gods." The Assyrian Empire, following the model, said, "Some of us are gods, the rest of us God sent, and the ones that God didn't send are riding those iron-wheeled chariots over there with the long spears that you guys don't have any of, superior weaponry." And down through history, it got more clever, in the age of colonization about 500 years ago, because they would say, "We're going to colonize you, and we're superior. So, I'm England, I'm going to come in and colonize you. What it means is I'm going to take your stuff and take your people and do whatever I want with your culture, including scrunching it. But you're colonized and you're part of England. You should feel much better about that."
And exactly right.
So down through time, what's happened is people started to wake up and say, "Excuse me, I really don't think this is a fabulously good way to run things." And there was that turning point in the middle of the 20th century where, prior to that moment, if you said to someone, "That person's an empire builder," you're really praising the person. Right? But after that, if you say something like, "That guy runs his family as if it's an empire, he's running the school board like it's his own empire," you're actually accusing him of being a control freak. And that being the case, as Native peoples would say, because they referred to this time at the last quarter of the 20th century and the first quarter of the 21st century as the Great Purification. In other words, after about 6,000 years of having these clomping societies beat up the partnership societies, everybody's pretty much getting tired of the clomping, controlling societies, and they're starting to fade. And so as we go into what they predicted to be the 7,000-year period, when a cycle should be complete, right at the beginning of that, in the first quarter of the 21st century, would be this highly charged, exciting, and very dangerous moment when the controlling elements of the culture are either dying off or being replaced, and all kinds of exciting things are happening, but the controlling crowd, who's very much invested in and even rewarded for keeping things the same, they conceive of this change as either death or dangerous or chaotic, and so they become more and more controlling, which creates more violence, more aggression, and more craziness, and that, the Native peoples that I worked with would say, is what you see on television. and in films and so on, you see the craziness played out, but the fact that it looks crazy tells you that that's because the partnership values and ideas are emerging much more powerfully, and they will change things.
Yes.
The question is, how long does it take, and how safe is it from here to there?
Absolutely. You know, if the cycles are where we perceive them to be, it seems to be a universal principle in the pattern of a cycle that when a cycle ends and a new one begins, as you go from revolution to revolution to revolution of the cycle, there's a transitional crisis when one ends and a new one begins. I would liken this to, on the first day of spring, the emergence of spring, the direct vertical rays of the sun cross up over the equator. And when that happens, there's tropical storms all around the equator at that time. And yet, for, you know, depending which hemisphere you live in, that marks the beginning of spring. And so it's at the equinoxes, as it were, that you're going to have this upset. Well, so it is in our societies. And so some of these things that we see that make it look like castles are falling down, it's the end of the world, sometimes in the long term turn out to be a blessing in disguise, because it's a transitional crisis that allows for the birth pangs of a new era. Now, the new era is not necessarily defined itself, but we are, I believe very strongly that what the Native Americans are saying about, is it 1975 to 2025 is the period of purification?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And you compound with that, the 7,000-year period may coincide and be synchronous with that. We are indeed. So the people who are trying to hold on to power are ultimately going to lose it anyway, aren't they, Chris?
Right, right. That's what you notice. And I've worked with a couple of well-known futurists. You had one on your show, Jim Lee. And,
Jim Lee, Resilience in the Future of Everyday Life, the book he wrote. Check that
book
on Amazon, folks.
Yeah, fabulous book. One of the things futurists will notice, that values and ideas are changing so dramatically that in many cases we're looking at ideas and values that are radically different from anything we've seen in the last 6,000 years. So, for example, to have a very controlling society, you need certain kinds of values to be out there. You need to have people who are simply obedient and conforming. You need to have a strong sense of institutionalization, and control needs to be the highest thing. The people who are in control, that's a wonderful thing, and so on. Now, what you notice is that when values shift, that can get very tricky. So, for example, for the last 6,000 years, and up to my lifetime, I would conceive of the world as, if I'm a normal Westerner, as mechanical things, mostly things, and they're mechanical or machine-like. So as a result, I have trouble programming digital things that my students laugh at because I look like an idiot to them. But you know, I'm somewhat, you know, hampered there. But that mechanical sense, and also the sense that those things ought to be more and more and more expensive, well, that kind of approach plays nicely into control. It's not part of it. It's just as okay. But all of a sudden, if that disappears, control gets much more difficult. So, for example, in information age, the students I teach, they don't think in things. They don't think in mechanical processes. They think in interconnected information that ought to be downloadable and free. Well, you can't run a controlling society on something that's downloadable, free, and you can't get your hands on it to control it. You're not going to happen.
No, you can't.
And that was an example given by Eric Garland, another futurist that I work with, who was giving a talk in my class. And he said to this class, he said, you can use all sorts of examples. I'm just giving these two. But he says, if you think about this, if you start thinking about the bigger patterns of history and then how things are changing, what happens is that you realize if that much is going on, if that much is changing and developing, then things are not going to stay the same, because that's the thing about control. When there's a transitional crisis, I very much like that that focus. When there's a transitional crisis, if everything starts to change, even though there can be a resistance to it, as long as people recognize that and sort of have a sense of where they are, they can move with it, even if there are dangers and difficulties. It's only the person who thinks that that's really just things breaking down and there's no hope, or the person who thinks, well, things never change. Those are the controllable ones, and the ones that aren't going to participate. But the ones who realize, no, this is a crisis, but it's going somewhere, then those people can be very active in it. And the activity can happen on any scale. It doesn't have to be, okay, I'm going to run out and take over the world or lead a movement like Gandhi or control all the wealth in the world. In fact, that's just more control.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's so well stated, because when we do understand that a crisis is coming, it's necessary for change, it doesn't have to necessarily mean that the world's falling apart, because the people who feel like they're losing control are going to lash out and act out. And look at just in the last 15 years, all the wars that have been going on and everything, the trouble in the Middle East, the Arab Springs, wars everywhere. And there would be less panic if we understood, well, this is time for it, and we could manage it a lot better. And the only way that we can understand that is if we understand the patterns, great and small. If we understand ourselves, we understand the world around us, because we are the models for the civilizations we create. If you build a house out of bricks, you have a brick house. If you build a civilization out of people, then you have an entity, a mass entity, which has a mind, a heart, and a body, which has feelings, thoughts, and it has stages of development, has good days, and it has bad days. And if we understand what time it is in terms of season, where we are with our own internal rhythms of not only ourselves, but of our country, understand where another country's internal rhythms are based on when they were come into existence, things going to make a lot of sense. As we're looking ahead, you know, you touched upon the future here and everything. Right now, certainly, we're in a state of flux. We're in a state of some people losing control while others are becoming empowered. Walls are coming down. The world is flat. We're having a free exchange of ideas and downloadable internet packets of information across open boundaries, whereas before everything was regimented, nationalistic, centralized in the military-industrial complex. Now we are becoming fluidic and somewhat introverted, some more intellectual, less physical, and so forth. But that's where we are right now in this energy stew. Do you have a look on the horizon as to what we might be headed towards in the course of this century? I know that's a loaded question.
Also a dangerous one.
I
think, well, one of the tricky pieces about it is that when you're looking at patterns and cycles, often those are the people historically who had one of two faces, because they were either schooled enough in some cycle that they knew it extremely well, so they were considered wise naturally, or they had become elders. They had been around long enough to observe cycles and patterns and were considered wise because they'd been around long enough to see it. The interesting thing about a pattern or a cycle is if you look ahead, you can look at the way patterns are playing out and say, it appears that that's the way that pattern's developing. And lots of times people think you're making a prediction. And technically you're not. You're saying, this is the way it looks as if this will play out. So, for example, if I were to say, for instance, I was in one of the, well, here's a great example, the environment, because I was in one of the very first environmental discussion groups that happened in a big way at Dickinson College in the late 60s. It was one of the first ones that talked about the environment, and we were, and I was a freshman, it was 1967, and I was given points about discussion groups with this group I was leading and so on, and there were words in there I stared at and thought, ecology. What in the world is that? I knew biology and things like that, but ecology, I didn't know that at all. And in those days, it was striking how ignorant we were about what was going on around us. Well, yeah. If you run down the road to 2013, where we are now, that's something that every school child knows. Not only do they know it, they know what happens if you have an interconnected environment and you poison one part of it. It's going to impact the other part. Yeah. That's a huge transformation in our time. So one of the things I could easily say is a pattern that is coming around, is going to happen, is that the more the poisoning happens, the more definitely citizens are going to want to say, we need to clean this place up. So one of my patterns would be just to say, I'm guessing if the native peoples are right about the roughly last quarter of the 20th century and roughly the first quarter of the 21st, that between that and the second quarter of the 21st, so that into the first half, the planet is going to start to get fairly seriously cleaned up. I would expect in the 2030s and 2040s and 2050s to see lots of cleaning up, cleaning up the food chain, the air, the water. Even now, there are purification methods of water that we never thought we'd have, and lakes can come back to life more quickly. But more importantly, we can revitalize water. Once upon a time, there used to be living water, and you could get healthy just by drinking it. Now, even purified water is fairly dead, but now people are saying, no, we got to put stuff back in it, bring it to life again. Those movements, if I look at education, you can see how we've gone from this very authoritarian cycle that professors go in and lecture from the standpoint of what they know. But now students have this leveler, the web, and the more that happens, the more you have things like virtual reality, then that education becomes more and more of an experience. So, for instance, you know, in a classroom, if you're just giving information, you have to test people to find out whether they got it or not. But a test is an artificial experience. It's not a real experience. A test means that you're admitting to the students that this is not a real experience. If they have a real experience, as I joke with my students, if you have a real experience, you don't need a test on it. If you have a date on the weekend and you come in on Monday morning, you don't need to give me I don't need to give you a quiz to find out how you did. You know how you did. You were there. And so if you have virtual reality, for instance, and all this information, I don't have to go in and sit through a lecture about the heart if I'm a nurse. I can walk into this virtual reality heart and see how it's working, and step back in the virtual reality body and see how it's playing out. The same way if I'm studying history, I don't have to have a lecture on Pickett's charge. I can have a virtual reality and be standing at the bottom of the hill and think, yeah, this really is intimidating. The weapons are lousy. You know, they could shoot me all day and I might not die, but it's a fairly spooky thing to have these people coming at you. It's a real experience much more, and that encourages education then to get out more in the world, and lots of alternative schools right now send their kids out into the world. John Taylor Gatto is quite famous for this. He has an alternative school where the kids want to learn about government, he sends them down to City Hall. He says, go down and find out about government and come back and tell the rest of us. So those kinds of things we can look at. If we take any part of the society, we can see what are the patterns that appear to be developing. And then the other part, the part that makes it unpredictable, which is why I dodged a predictability bullet early on here, is that those things then are synergistic. They connect with each other, and they then might really expand in ways we never even thought of. And so you see the patterns playing out, but you think, and there might be something even more that happens there that I couldn't even see. I mean, when I was growing up, it's very interesting that when I was 9 years old, I remember vividly sitting in a lecture where this guy came into our third grade class and said, you know, when you're older, you will all have an individual phone. You can carry it around with you, and you'll all have your own phone number. And, of course, we had just barely gotten, I'm old enough that we just barely gotten phones in the house that we were getting used to. We thought, well, carrying around your own phone, what would that be like? Now it's practically passe. When I say I have a cell phone, my students tisk at me as if I'm in the Dark Ages or just came over in the Mayflower. A cell phone, that was a huge future when I was a kid. Now it's practically the past.
The future is here.
Yeah. Similarly, I was struck by the fact that for all the interesting things that they said, there were things that when they were looking for the predictions, certain things pulled together that they never could have guessed, and the explosion was huge. And so for this guy who was from the telephone company, having your own phone was the height of the future. Realizing that that would be replaced by something even more sophisticated, this whole different universe, this information universe that you are in, wouldn't have occurred to him. And so that's the other thing. When you're looking into the future, you realize that synergy, when patterns get together and then they produce these higher patterns, you think, okay, that's one we actually didn't think of. And I think it's one of the nice things. And that, by the way, one of the things I like about this is your cycles, because there are lots of big cycles that are very, very important. But I think those are the cycles you have that you've tracked through history of the physical, emotional, and mental. Those are very helpful for refining larger cycles or contributing to larger cycles or defining them, because they have movements that we can understand. And I think when you and I were trying to look up when the Sumerians turned up about, say, 3600, 3400 something so BC, and trying to say, okay, how did they get away with that? I mean, imagine somebody turning up in your neighborhood right now and saying, hi, I'm God, I'm here to take you over. Yeah, right. Not a chance. But why did people go for that then? And there might have been lots of reasons, but when you were looking at your cycle, you said, well, the physical, that was a time when the physical swing was very, very high. And so all they had to do was be physically impressive, have bigger technology, like the Assyrians with their iron-wheeled chariots that nobody else had, and there you go. So those are also very helpful when you're looking into the future and so on, the ones that you had that when I first met you quite a while ago that I was very impressed by. I thought, well, this is a very useful tool.
Well, history never repeats itself, but it often rhymes, as Mark Twain said. And so it's not only just who and what is happening, but it's when. And there are physically based times when you're going to have a hierarchical pattern flowchart of dominance, as opposed to more emotional times when you're going to have a cooperative egalitarian culture. But I so clearly understood everything that you just said, Chris. It's helping me to understand it more. We're going to go to the phones here. And folks, anyone else out there that would like to call in, just call us here at area code 347-884-9593. That's 347-884-9593. Going here to a caller from area code 302. Hi, you're on the Cycles of Change radio show. Are you there?
Hi, this is Jim Lee. Great show. Very interesting to hear both of you talk about all of this stuff. You know, we've been talking a little bit about sort of a generational shift, a big shift running from sort of a traditional society to something that we could call kind of post-traditional. And I'm kind of wondering from, you know, either a cycles perspective or an astrological perspective, what sort of window or what time period would be ripe for, I guess, what I would call kind of a Wile E. Coyote moment, you know, that idea, that time when we all just realize that we're running on vapors. And that shift has to happen.
All right. Chris, you want to take that?
Yes. And thanks to Jim for that good question. And again, that's the author of Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life. One of the things that helps look into the future, something like this. Yeah, the time frames were interesting to me because when the Native peoples first talked about the Great Purification from roughly 1975 to 2025, and I was talking to some cultural historians and said, yes, roughly as we come to the end of the 20th century and go into the first half of the 21st, you're going to see big shifts, but there will be moments in there that will be very profound. And I happened to, by just accident of studying symbol systems, look at astrological dating, and there was using astrological symbols, there was a moment that one of the pioneers of astrology in the 20th century was Jung, the famous Swiss psychologist, and a famous French philosopher, Dane Rudyard. And when they would look at it, they would say, okay, let's, for instance, look at a couple of planets that symbolize huge change, and they happen to be together in the 60s going into the early 70s. Well, when they are in a pattern that they are really pushing against each other, then it's like you're going to have the 60s on steroids. It's like the 60s at a higher level. And that time frame, the Native peoples were also very interested in. It was roughly 2010 to 2011, 2010 or 2011 to about 2015, 2016. And in fact, that was one of the reasons that 2012 got to be so interesting to a couple of writers, and they focused on it. But when I would go to Native peoples, for instance, they would always say, it's not, yeah, 2012, fine. That means that people will usually be fairly either awake or agitated by that time. But it's really this time frame of about 5 years, from 2010, 2011 to 2015, 2016, when the symbols that we've observed through history, when they turn up, there's this huge collective change. And that's going on in this time right now. So here, sort of two-thirds of the way through the Native people's Great Purification, is this very intense transformation moment. And it's interesting about the transformation moment because the sorts of things that I hear when I'm talking to people, and that's either going to be in my public work or if I'm doing work with individuals, small groups, and so on, people feel as if they're suddenly waking up. They suddenly have a sense of urgency, or they have a sense of there's a destiny and they're trying to figure out what it is, or some sense of purpose has seized them, or something's suddenly fallen apart, or they feel just dragged around and thrown around by their lives, and as if they're trying to be awakened to something. And it's just this moment that you feel as if, yep, all kinds of things are really going on that resemble those other times in history when there's rapid cultural change. Only this time, if we're at the end of a longer period, then that can be much more profound and at the same time more hidden. Because the interesting thing about a very controlling society, and we saw this when Edward Gibbon analyzed the rise and fall of the Roman Empire in fabulous detail in the 1700s, you know, Gibbon's Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, very famous in academia. What you notice is when a very controlling society is fading, as Gibbon commented, you know, the leaders get horrified about it. Oh, the world is coming to apart, coming apart. Horrible things are happening. Let's just think about security and not freedom at all. And what's more, let's run around and fall on our swords. So it gets to be fairly chaotic and fairly crazy. And that's. But the point is, the other thing you noticed was nobody's telling the public what's really going on. Mm. And what we notice now is, and of course, the media are controlled by about four or five guys. Practically all males, and practically everything you're going to see on television or films or read in newspapers or see on billboards is controlled by a very small number of people. And there's that sort of funny moment when at a journalist conference, Rupert Murdoch was asked before he got into serious trouble, he was asked by a journalist expecting not to get a serious answer, Mr. Murdoch, can you control with your news the way people think? To which Murdoch replied, well, not yet, but I'd certainly like to. And you could sort of feel that the chuckle spread through the room, people realizing, I don't think he really meant to say that. He didn't mean to admit that he's trying to control all of us. But that's what people start to notice. They think, well, I'm not actually getting a very accurate picture of the world, am I, in what's going on here, because the controlling people are the ones who are running the news. And so people start looking for alternative sources. They start trusting more, talking to each other, trying to find out what's going on. And even their worldview shifts relative to how they view the world. And that's another time when patterns and cycles and higher orders of things are really important, because it helps them orient even when the news gets fairly crazy. And frankly, according to the people I talk to, fairly unbelievable.
So every now and then, Wile E. Coyote is going to run out of land and be running on air, take a look down, and go, oh, it's time to fall.
That's right. And I think between now and 2015, 2016, we're going to notice more and more and more of that. Lots of times when you think, if we look at the world, and quite seriously, because some people say, well, you know, things never change. Well, usually they haven't paid much attention to history. I was thinking about it today. My wife and I are renting Downton Abbey. It's very popular, so popular that one of the characters in Iron Man 3 is watching it from his hospital bed. I thought, okay, this is interesting. This is a really popular show. Well, one of the things that has to strike you about Downton Abbey is, look at the way those people lived, even in the early 1900s. I mean, it's fascinating to Anglophiles or people who like that sort of thing, but heaven's sakes, that you watch it and think, thank heavens we don't live that way anymore. These people who think because they're servants, their lives don't really have that much meaning and their dreams will never come true. People don't think that way anymore. And so when you look at the shifts from the 50s and the 60s and 70s, even in the time, say, that I've been alive, you notice these dramatic changes in attitudes and values. You think sooner or later these are going to start having a greater and greater impact, and that is what you notice. Right now, again, go back to the 50s, just coming out of World War II. We just destroyed all the dictators in the world, so we must be wonderful, and everything about us must be great. Within 30 years, every American institution has got a reformer climbing all over it. We started wanting to change how we do human relationships, how we do families, how we raise children. Watergate came along, how we do politics, how we think about education, how we think about medicine. In 1999, the medical industry studied itself and issued a report called To Err Is Human and admitted that they killed more people a week than the automobile industry, who up to that moment really wanted to have the title. So everywhere you look, the society is in this huge, massive change. And I think it's right. It's a Wile E. Coyote moment where you look and you think, hello, we don't have a foundation here anymore, because the old stuff that we thought was working actually isn't working. So the other side of that is you have to get very busy constructing something. At that moment, Wile E. Coyote would really like somebody to build a very fast and effective scaffold, because his plans to control and zap this poor little thing are not working.
Acme may not always have a package or a product that's going to solve all our problems, but one of the things that will help us is our understanding. You know, we tend to build empires that are right for the time, it works, and because we have a linear concept, we say, this is the way. Mm-hmm. And so we believe that this is the way that it should always be. It should have been like this all along. And so what happens is that lasts for as long as a particular cycle that was high at the time remains high, and then when it starts to fall, the way doesn't work anymore. So are you an empire builder, or are you an empire builder? It all depends on what time it is. Hey, We got another call. Jim, I hope you hang on here for a little bit, but I see another caller coming in from area code 302 with some comments or questions. Caller, you're on the line here at the Cycles of Change. Are you there?
Hello?
Hello. I can hear you.
So my question to you, Chris, is on a personal level, you know, I see people, you know, hoarding SpaghettiOs, and like I get up in the morning and meditate, and then I get a, you know, crazy phone call, or, you know, see people that are, you know, telling me to turn everything into silver, and like on a personal level, you know, and you kind of get a little disturbed and you meditate again, and you, on a personal level, how are we supposed to negotiate just as an individual in this change?
Good question.
That's a good question. I think once again, that's where two things are going to go back to the two original tools, stories and patterns. That is, and I mean stories in a bigger sense, that is to say, interacting with real human beings doing real human things. And then looking at the patterns of our own lives, saying, okay, when I interact in a really human way, not something artificial, when something comes on television about the State Department or the military or something, unless I'm working for those organizations, they don't have much to do with me on a personal level in to solve that immediate problem. Somebody from the State Department is going to run down and help me prioritize my life. To do that, I have to fall back on the real human experiences and the kinds of patterns and cycles I've seen in my life, and to understand more and more, to say, okay, where am I, and where am I in my life? So, for example, if I'm in my late 20s, the pattern is such that I'm trying to figure out how to adapt to the external society. However, if because David mentioned Gail Shee's passages, if I'm in a midlife crisis, what I'm really doing is I'm in my high adulthood trying to understand what it means to be a real adult and be a person. I figured out how to get along with society. Now, who am I? And then I'm going to wed those two. I pay attention to where I am in my life, and then also pay attention to what's going on around me. What are my relationships? How do they function? What skills do I have? Which have I mastered? And so on. All those are patterns and tools that can help us, and the stories we know about our own lives and the real human experiences around us.
And there's going to be dissonance sometimes between what we feel or what we intuit versus what is the system at that time. So we've got to remember, there's a little Jonathan Livingston Seagull in all of us.
Yeah, well, one thing I noticed, Chris, is while when I'm in service to another individual, nothing else matters. And I cannot be taken off. You know, I cannot get anxious. And I cannot, while I'm serving someone, nothing can penetrate.
Mm-hmm. And I think, and that's a really good example of saying, okay, this is a real human experience I have, and I know from the patterns of my life, this is really something that's deeply meaningful for me and grounding. And so even when things are crazy, because as David says, in a crisis time, we're going to have there's going to be lots of dissonance around, and that becomes part of the experience. And we know about handling those because the person didn't get to you by feeling wonderful and happy and healthy. They came because they had a problem. And then that becomes part of the pattern. You have the skills to engage this person in a positive way.
I'd like to shift the question over to Jim Lee. Jim, are people perhaps asking different questions now? That was a great question we had just now. Are people asking different questions now than they were 30 years ago? And is it likely that in the directions we may be heading in, are we going to be asking ourselves different questions in the future? A little vague? I could be more vague. Jim, you want to tackle that one? Oh, Jim, are you there?
We may have lost Jim.
Oh, we may have. We have. Well, I'll tell you what. We do have another caller coming in from area code 302. Let me see. Okay, caller from 302, you are there. Can you hear me?
Yes, this is Jim Lee. And,
Jim, okay, we're connected.
Got him back.
Yeah, I
wanted to sort of follow up on the question that you had for me.
Yes.
Just regarding changing values and shifts in terms of the questions that we ask. And one of the things that I've observed is that we sort of seem to be in a 40-year cycle that moves between 20-year emphasis on building relationships and 20 years that's more focused on building wealth, as it were. And if you look at that, essentially what that says is that in many ways we're going through the 1970s again, where we're looking at matters of social equality. We're looking at fixing the system. We're looking at, return to a more peaceful type of government. And we'll probably be in this type of transition at least until 2020, at which point I think the shifts in the emphasis will probably become a little bit more material again. So, that's my own observation. Take it for what you will, but I think that the focus right now is a little bit more internal, much more relationship-driven. I think people are trying to figure out their relationship with their stuff and their relationship with each other, and we're definitely seeing a realignment of priorities right now.
Jim, you know, it's very interesting that you said those things, because while I was looking at something entirely different, my cycles of time that Chris mentioned, Kala Rhythms, K-A-L-A Rhythms, I came up with exactly the same conclusions. I agree with you entirely, and we're going to figure out what to do with our stuff, become less materialistic and be a little bit more humanistic. And so that's going to be a societal thing, and it may affect us on an individual level, perhaps. So a caller who asked that wonderful question, may I ask your name, who was called in and asked, what does an individual do when you're working on, you have to focus on just what you're doing because you're doing healing?
Ann Wilkinson,
who was a guest not long ago on our site from Imogo Life Healing. Marvelous. That was a great question. So we're looking at, really, when you start understanding the patterns of yourself, understanding the patterns of society, looking at it across time, then there comes, okay, that's a great abstract theory, but what are we going to do for it? You know, Chris, you said that a test is, what was it you said about a test, Chris? It's a false experience?
It's artificial.
Artificial
that experience. If I'm, classroom experience is an artificial experience, so I need a test to find out if anybody took anything away from it. In a real experience, I don't need to quiz people and test them. They know what they experienced, and they might want to process it. They might want to put it in a larger pattern to understand its meaning, but you don't have to check to see if they were there.
That's why I liked your question so much, Anne, because sooner or later you're going to have to ask, well, if this is something that's true about all of us, then it should have something experiential for all of us. And you have to ask, not being selfish, but what's in it for me? And so what questions should we ask? And what does it mean to the individual when we're living in this society in different times? And that is very much in flux right now. I mean, after 9/11, the Arab Spring, the transition that we're going through, the death of the machine age. Well, my cycles I saw from 1978 until 1864 was the age of purification. And I came up with that concept in the late 1970s, and here I'm watching it happen when we're going to clean up the world and the environment. But it's all wheels within wheels, cycles within cycles. Now, you work a lot in healing, do you not, Anne?
Yes,
and you
I
work
do.
On individuals, and yes. And so when you're working, you're in a field that has gone from occasionally having alternative healing supplement traditional healing to really traditional healing is becoming integrated with things that were considered very esoteric because people are looking for more in the holistic experience of their lives and for the healing, are they not, Anne?
It's interesting you talk about experiential learning, experiential understanding. If someone uses something that's considered alternative and they have a great experience, and then someone who's very non-alternative kind of poo-poos that experience, they actually lose credibility. And that's what's starting to happen with the public. They're rapidly leaving their own experiences, not giving their power away, and they're becoming much more self-educated and they can make choices. So I see people that are on, you know, one side of the fence or the other. They're either really stuck in fear and they're giving away their power and they're stuck to the old ways, or they've just had enough of that and they're ready to just release and, really look at themselves and look at how they got where they are and what they can do to change it, and they're open to doing anything. And they're not tied to what their insurance companies recommend or the doctor that may be getting a gift from this particular, avenue of treatment or whatever. They're starting to see through some of these things. I'm noticing that the public is becoming more educated.
Yes, absolutely. They are. It's a rising intellectual cycle, it's a rising emotional cycle, and a declining physical cycle. So what that's my view of the world. Thank you very much. That means we're becoming less materialistic, and there's a rise in the age of reason and a rise in the age of romanticism. So, Chris, is there any particular message you might have for someone who's going through all this? We're asking questions. The answers are different. We're getting answers when we weren't getting answers before. Sometimes the answers are in conflict. And a person is just trying to figure out what is the system when they find out the system is crumbling beneath them and they feel like Wile E. Coyote. So what do we do in this case? I mean, this is almost a parallel to Anne's question. And I'm looking ahead into the future, especially since I read Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life, very well written, by the way. Are there any other things we can draw from? Is understanding patterns and knowing cycles enough?
I think it can be very, very useful, and I'm going to add that to Anne's comment about the physical real experiences that you have. You can't be talked out of them, and say that if people are looking for something to help prioritize right now, they can do what the educational expert Ken Robinson always recommends. Look at everything you've done creatively as a model. So, for instance, if I look at how I learned to do anything from speak the language or a second language to learn a sport, to learn music, to learn my craft or profession, whatever it is, I watch what happens there. I watch that I do make mistakes, and I learn from those mistakes. Sometimes I don't understand what's going on around me. I feel a bit overwhelmed. But if I keep moving in the direction of wanting to master that skill, it gets better and better. Because that's why if people use their real, actual, creative experiences in their lives, they'll see lots of times the strategies that they need to respond to difficult circumstances. So, for instance, if someone says, as Jim did quite rightly, people are wanting more peaceful government, that means war is going to be more reprehensible. They're going to see it more. Mm-hmm. Right now, we're very upset, most of the people. I mean, when I teach kids, when I was in college in the 60s and 70s, 11 to 12% of the kids, roughly, were opposed to the Vietnam War. When I teach a contemporary moral problems class at the University of Delaware, 70 to 80% of the kids are opposed to any war. And so there's a big difference there. But what happens is they're more and more longing for peace and less tolerant, but that means they will see more war because they will be upset by it more. I usually ask my students to think about world wars and something like Vietnam or invading Iraq or Iran or something. How many times has that happened? How many times has the United States been involved in that since the 1890s? And people guess around. The answer is something over 300. And we just sort of took it for granted for a long period of time. But as Jim suggests, if we want a more peaceful government, more and more we're going to see that and think, yeah, we really don't want that. But we also notice that in our lives, when I really want to move away from something, I get very disturbed by it, and suddenly I might even see it everywhere. I might even say in my life, I'd really like to be less controlling, say, with my children or my friends. And I look around and think, oh, gee, many Christmas, I'm controlling practically everybody here. This is awful. And the more I see it, the more I think, okay, I've got to get out of here. And it appears as if it's almost everywhere until I realize it's my awareness of it and my wanting to move away from it that is part of the process, because I've seen that before when I learn something or master something. And therefore, that becomes part of the skill. So if people, when they ask these questions, go back to how did it work when you were doing it, when you were learning something, when you were developing an ability and so on, when you were involved in the creative process, what are the stages? And you'll often find those patterns and so on helping us because we've lived through them.
So if we understand ourselves, we can understand the world around us. You know, in religion, in yoga, and so forth, there are classic questions that come up, and one that comes up sometimes is that many times the teachers are given satsangs will say, your purpose of being here is to realize yourselves. Mm-hmm. And then someone will ask, well, isn't that selfish? Isn't that selfish to say that my purpose is to realize myself? What about the world? What about other people and everything like that? And questions that are often vague, they're usually given on the subtle level. Why? Because eventually I think the students come to find out that in realizing yourself, you begin to understand everything around you, which you can't do until you realize yourself first. Guru Maharaji Mahesh Yogi said that we are all like cells in a great organism. And if we realize that we're a cell, then we can realize the organism. And as above, so as we are, so is the nation that we make. So I'd say the French must be a country filled with a lot of romantic individuals because it's such a lovely, lovely place. And really, it's really whatever you are, physical, emotional, intellectual, that's what your country will be. And that'll be the personality of really, it's a fractal relationship on and on. So cycles within cycles within cycles. Absolutely. Are there any other times, Chris, that remind you of times that we're in or may be headed to? I love the example that you gave of Sumer and brought in the 7,000-year cycle, which may be ending right now. Of all times to be born, what a confluence of synchronies and transitional crises and births of new eras we must be in now. Are there any other times that come to mind as we look at cycles across ages, regions, cultures, and time?
Historians are always fond of comparing whatever's going on to the Roman Empire, because the Roman Empire began as a republic and switched over to an empire, of course. And lots of people were very distressed about that. The philosopher Cicero, quite famously, who'd also been a senator. And one of the interesting things for me is to look at that, because you hear a lot of the same conversation in America, and also, by the way, in Star Wars. It's the old republic and then it becomes an empire. And Star Wars is about to open again in a couple of years. The movie that will not go away. So, for instance, in the beginning of the Roman Empire, once there's this realization that the old republic is dead, there is an explosion of people wanting to talk about what's going on, and the emperors are aware of this. And so, for instance, in somewhere around the 1st, 2nd century in Rome, when the Republic was long gone by then and the Empire's up and running, one of the things that the rulers did was throw the philosophers and the astrologers out of Rome. Because, of course, the astrologers could point to the cycles, and the philosophers would make people think in these big, powerful ways. One of the philosophers who was teaching those days that got thrown out was a former slave named Epictetus. And Epictetus has a book called The Enchiridion. It's a manual for living, and periodically we study it in the Seventh Academy, and we're going to do it again later this year, because I usually refer to his little book as the greatest self-help book ever written, because he starts by giving something that's just completely practical, which is a corollary of what you were just saying, David, that he says, what is it that you can actually do? The things you've mastered, the skills and abilities you have, what can you actually do? Those are the things you should be doing. And so if they're the things you came here to do, you should do them. If they're not, don't. It will only be frustrating. And people come to Epictetus and say, but Epictetus, society needs help, the state needs help. And he'd say, yes, it does need help. It needs good laws. Do you write good laws? It needs roads. Do you pave good roads? And he goes right back to, okay, fine, what do you have to offer? What do you have to offer? Because that's something in this sense of the higher order reflecting the more specific order, that will be what really is uniquely contributing and what you got born to do for this larger entity that we worry about when we think, okay, my life is a mess and so is the society, which should I worry about first? And very often, if someone makes a suggestion about our individual lives, we go back to worrying about the society. Well, that's still a mess. If I just take care of myself, I'm being selfish. Whereas, in fact, Epictetus' idea is, no, you got born to do these unique things that are synergistically related to other people's uniqueness, and that helps transcend all kinds of things that would then be progressive and positive and helpful to any larger order, like your community or your nation. So that's a time that we think about, because a lot of that same kind of thinking, people like Cicero and Epictetus, that's back now, too. You just were quoting them, David.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be flying at an altitude of 0 feet. If at any time this flight is to crash, there will be masks that pop down from the roof. If you're sitting next to your child, put the oxygen mask on your face first so that you'll be able to remain conscious and share the mask and put the mask on your child's face so that it may live too. So, you know, it's sometimes things may seem a bit odd, but there's many different ways of looking at so many things. Mm-hmm. And seeing what everyone else has seen and thinking what no one else has thought. I believe, you know, I want to address this question, too, that I just asked you, Chris, that in some ways I think we're going into the Baroque era. In the Baroque era, it was a heyday for the arts. You look at the beautiful buildings with the fancy Ionian scrolls and the the works of Johann Sebastian Bach and the entire Baroque era, the music that came out of there. The church was institutionalized, but the working class were peasants. And that is very much an opposite of now, of, well, where we're coming from in the 1900s and the 20th century. It was a heyday of the working class and the empowerment of the unions, and a physically based nation of the United States became a world leader because we were an industrial giant. And so we were able to excel at, you know, guns, money, and tanks and so forth and warfare. But what's happening now, that's the world that is in decline right now. That's the declining tide. And so we're seeing a rise of Asia because the power centers are shifting not from the physical but towards the intellectual. And so the Foundation for the Study of Cycles had observed that there's about a 500-year rise and fall between power shifting from east and west. And I think that relates to an intellectual cycle going on. So with that being the case, working class now is becoming more peasantly. And so it's not if you can turn wrenches, you can support your home and have a car in the garage and send your child to college. It's going to be a little bit more of, there's a bright side to this too, because with the age of reason, the arts are coming back and we're giving value to intellectualism and intellectual achievements. And look at the information age that's rising. That's just one kind of parallel that I see where we're going into. There are many blessings coming, and what hasn't long been recognized is I believe that there's an era of romanticism rising now. Chris, you mentioned that there were times when we had an egalitarian form of cooperation between people, and I believe that the times ahead of us for the rest of this century, all of the next century, and some of the one beyond, is going to be more of that, a rise of feminine energy, a decline in masculine energy. And I'm not saying either one is good or bad. They're both absolutely necessary, but they're both in flux, and we should understand where that is. That's where the difference between physical and emotional. Now, intellectual energy is neither masculine or feminine. It's both. And so you can think of it as electricity. We have positive, negative, and neutral wires going through every wire in your house, going to your outlets. But in any case, history does have some lessons for us, does it not? And it really simplifies it. I like what you said in the beginning of the program, Chris, where in this information age, when we're overloaded, inundated with TMI, too much information, taking on understanding of history and thinking of things in the concept of cycles might just seem like something else to learn. But in fact, it's what puts everything into perspective. Otherwise, we can be seeing all the things happening around us as a flurry of pages from a book that has no chapter, no outline, no cover. But when you understand how each one of these things fits in its place in the terms of cycles, when we have cycles within cycles everywhere around us, then all of a sudden there is order and you have a navigation menu of time and you can navigate the currents of time once you understand the patterns. Which is what the ancients did, didn't they?
Exactly. That's exactly right. There was, when I was, one of the things that struck me when I was studying Native peoples, for instance, was they would always say the most important thing is remembering and the worst thing is forgetting. But they also said nothing is going to be forgotten. And of course, there are lots of teachings that would appear to be stories that were actually could be understood in terms of various cycles and patterns that they would focus on, so people would have an idea where they are. And you would stand in a tradition. You'd stand in a tradition of family generations, of historical movements within your culture and so on. And so that's one of the things I noticed, that even some of the people I worked with, and I thought, these people have been subjected to pretty nasty colonization for 500 years, and they still have a kind of presence on the planet that I really envy. And I used to think that in those days to say, I realized that they had this bigger sense of patterns and cycles than I do as a result of really carrying their history with them, and they knew it extremely well. And that's one of the, lots of times that's why the cultural history, the family history was very important when you'd realize, and they're looking at patterns in it. I noticed when I studied religions, cultural traditions specifically, so religion, history of religions class I was taking, but I was studying patterns in West Africa, and I noticed that sometimes a child, very often a child would be named for a grandparent or a great-grandparent. And when I ask why that happened, they would say, because we know in the patterns of things, and the wise people have confirmed it when this child is being born, this child is going to carry rhythms and patterns for that generation and so on, to make sure, not to be limited by it, but to make sure that that isn't forgotten, that generation, that movement, that part of those individuals and so on, that part of our history. And so the child would be told all kinds of stories about that person and what was going on around him. So the child would then take on a new name when he was 7, 8, 9, 10, and sometimes even another new name when he was a teenager and had a vision of something or did something exceptional or remarkable. And so they would say, yes, that old pattern is being remembered through this person. And then this person can build on that pattern but move into his or her own version of, this is the pattern I'm involved with, but I know what I stand on. I know the patterns that I'm coming from. I know what's happening around me. And, of course, because of the perception of nature, there are always kinds of debates among academia about how really environmentally conscious Native peoples were, failing to notice that Native peoples were really paying attention to all the patterns around them they could get their hands on, and how the culture handled that varied, but the patterns were extremely important. So yes, that is what you notice, and those patterns can even be healing in quite remarkable ways. My wife is one of the best facilitators of family constellation work that works in a very unusual way with multi-generational patterns. And lots of times where the understanding that a pattern has to be, it's going to be whole and it's going to move. So if the consciousness of the culture or the family tries to mess with that, it has to be remembered and repaired, as Native peoples used to say. And some of those orders are orders we're even aware of now. I mean, people didn't think about higher orders. And I mean, you and I were talking about this, David, that in the 70s and 80s, we'd start talking about orders and patterns, and people's eyes would glaze over, and they'd start thinking, how soon is lunch, or when is this guy going to shut up? Right? But all of a sudden, people started talking about birth order. And someone said, I am the third child, and that describes me. How do they know that about me? And people started realizing that there are these patterns that we notice even in families and so on in immediate ways, that you think, okay, if there are all kinds of patterns like that going on out there, and we can orient ourselves with those, they're hugely helpful. Again, they give a sense of context and meaning. To return to that example, what if I woke up in the morning, what if I got in the car one morning and I had no clue about traffic patterns and what a green light is supposed to do? I didn't notice, I wasn't clued into any of the cycles. Or what if I thought, well, I'm going to go someplace, I'm in a hurry, so I'll wait until 5 o'clock Friday afternoon in downtown Philly to get there in a hurry. Not going to happen. You got the cycle wrong on that one. That's when everybody's trying to get someplace in a hurry. And so, no, you're not going to get there in a hurry. So all of these to say they can be very helpful to us when we're trying to organize our lives, strategize, prioritize, or just find meaning in something.
Hence the saying, those who fail to remember history are condemned to repeat it. And these ideas are not new. They have been studied as far back as ancient Sanskrit, where we have kal, which is the word for cycles, and the Buddhist concept of ciphers. And the yugas are periods of immense time. And the Chaldeans and others were looking at the great astrological ages of about 26,000 years. And they were able to, nobody lived 26,000 years to count these things. They were able to put these things together because they saw the patterns great and small, recognized it in something small, saw it in something great. Is there any wonder that Blake spoke of seeing the entire universe in a single grain of sand? And then you mentioned the Native Americans were seeing things that were not recognized by those of us who are descended from the European invasion. And there's an old saying that says it takes one to know one. And if you're not aware of something yourself, you're not going to recognize when somebody else is looking at it. So it's going to sound like gibberish. what's happening now is this wonderful rise of consciousness. I've been talking about the age of reason, the rise of romanticism, but let's look at it in terms of consciousness. Beneath the clamor and the din of the entire machine age was this rising renaissance of when these cycles were going to finally break through into the high half, when the minds and the hearts of the people of the world would awaken collectively. We are moving en masse globally. There is a collective consciousness going on, not just a collective unconscious that moves in rhythm itself. And the rhythm is saying this is a new day. It's not the world into which we're born. And that we are recognizing and having the emotional intelligence to be able to realize some of the things that are on the subtle level. And if you underestimate the power of the subtle level, I remind you that what is written in Sanskrit is that from the unmanifest comes the manifest. So from things unseen do all things come. And this may be where we're headed now. Sorry to get a little philosophical here, but you know, you bring it out in me, Chris, after I hear some of the things you say.
And I think that's the nice thing about that I noticed about Native societies too, was that the children were trained to be very analytical in conversations with each other, and at the same, so their skills, their minds could be very sharp because they knew it's not I'm picking somebody else's ideas apart, rather this is a tool I use for clarity, not this is the right way to think, but a tool that I use for learning and understanding and being clear. And they were also highly trained in dialogue and very good at listening and all kinds of really sophisticated skills, so that when they came to talk about something that would be otherwise considered abstract, because they're thinking about it as a tool and relating it to their lives immediately, it didn't feel abstract and conceptual to them. So lots of times when I would be, and that's the beauty of a lot of Native societies, is if I would be talking about something abstractly, then someone would say something like, yes, and if you have a seed, if you just have a small seed, it doesn't look like anything, and if you put it in the ground and nurture it and water it and feed it, lots of times you think it's just going to be there, and all of a sudden, according to some unknown order, what emerges is this huge plant or tree, and all seeds that look like that give you that tree, but never exactly the same tree. We recognize that those are trees, that's one order, but each one is individual at the same time, and the growth process is individual but similar at the same time, and the patterns would be very sophisticated, but in our minds are these very practical pictures. We know what a tree looks like. We know that no two are alike, but we can tell the difference between this being an oak over here and that's an evergreen over there, a fir tree of some sort or another, and so on. And so even the things that were more philosophical for them, they were also very good then in bringing that right down to their lives, and also then having stories that demonstrated the patterns too, especially transformational patterns.
That's a wonderful example, a very wonderful example. And may we realize that we're all leaves on the same tree. So what we do to each other, we do to ourselves, because we are all one. Moving in rhythm, navigating the currents of time, and growing our collective consciousness as a unified organism, a living system ourselves. Chris Largent of the7thacademy.com, I thank you so much for joining us tonight. You're certainly going to be invited back here in the future. Jim Lee, are you still on?
I am still here, yes. Thank you.
Jim, I really enjoyed the interview that we did on resilience in the future of everyday life. Is there a website that you'd like to announce for people to find you?
Sure, yeah, you can find some of my comments on cycles and social transition on my blog. It's www.resilience-economics.com.
Thank you very much. And Ann Wilkinson, I happen to live in the same region of the country as you, and I know that you have a reputation for being an excellent healer. Is there a site that you would like people to be able to find you?
HandsOnHealthDE.com. That's the site for me.
HandsOnHealthDE.com. Thank you very much. Chris, I thank you so much for being on the Cycles of Change radio program here at blogtalkradio.com/cycles. It has been a
thanks
privilege
and
honor.
David. It's been wonderful for me. Thank you, David, for having me on. And thanks to Jim and Ann, too.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you, Chris. I love your work.
Thank you, Ann.
Great show.
Mutual.
Great show. You're smart guys.
Thank you, Jim.
It's been wonderful. Thank you for your collective energy. This is David Katzmaier, your host for the Cycles of Change, signing out for tonight. Thanks for listening.